From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. You can't hold UConn down even after an academic suspension. Ahead on Only a Game, a look at the resurgent men's program and the Huskies' dual championship. Also, former Baylor star Brittany Griner talks about her new autobiography, and Karen Given makes a top-secret foray into the shop of a flag maker whose client is a certain August and National golf course that may or may not be in the news this weekend. Also coming up, the Mixed Gender Basketball Association prepares for launch, but will people flock to see co-ed cagers?
People are going to pay for the unknown. People want to see how men play against women and how the women play against men. It's that unknown factor.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Celebrating one championship is fun. Celebrating two is, well, more fun. The University of Connecticut did that this week after the men's and women's teams each claimed the NCAA national basketball title. It's only the second time in Division I history that a school has held both titles. UConn was also the first team to do it back in 2004. Joining me now is Paul Meyerberg of USA Today. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we're joined by John Altavilla, who covers the Connecticut women's team for the Hartford Courant. John, welcome back.
Thank you so much for asking.
Paul, I want to start with you. The men's final featured the highest combination of seeds in history. UConn was a 7 seed, Kentucky an 8 seed. Can you put into perspective how improbable that men's title game was?
Well, in the historical sense, it's entirely improbable and entirely unpredictable that two teams coming from such high seeds out of some tough brackets would advance to the title game. In the smaller picture, UConn, as a 7 seed, probably properly ranked. Kentucky as an 8 seed. They were in preseason number one. They certainly had the talent. So for them, reaching the title game was a preseason goal. Just coming in as an 8 seed makes it kind of hard to believe.
John, for the first time in history, the women's final featured two undefeated teams, UConn and Notre Dame. On paper, that would suggest the makings of a great showdown. That's not what we got on Tuesday night. The Huskies won by 21. Was that margin a surprise, even though UConn was favored?
I have learned over the years of watching UConn play, and I've been to every single Final Four they've played in this last string of seven, that UConn just operates in a different stratosphere. To sort of reference your question that started this conversation, the only 7-8 seeds that ever blossom in the spring in women's basketball are in flower pots, really. It's not, it'll never happen, not in my lifetime.
Paul, the men's team was banned from the tournament last year on academic grounds. Final Four MVP Shabazz Napier said after the finals, "This is what happens when you ban us." What has changed at UConn since the NCAA sanctions?
Yeah, you know, speaking to a few players this past week in Dallas at the Final Four, they did say that when Kevin Ollie, their second-year coach, replaced Jim Calhoun, who was a Hall of Fame legend, as John knows, he instituted mandatory study halls, class checks. You know, if you didn't go to class and they caught you, you'd be running in the morning. Ways to kind of keep guys on their toes and make sure that they made academics a greater priority.
John, at least back in the 90s, when I was going to games down there, the guys on the men's team would attend the women's game and cheer for them. Is that still the case?
Oh, yeah, they do now. There's a real esprit de corps between the two programs, the players. And one of the biggest differences on campus now, and in terms of the alignment, is the relationship that Gino Auriemma has with Kevin Ollie. You know, Kevin Ollie was an 18-year-old freshman from Los Angeles when he showed up at UConn. Gino was already well into his coaching career at that point, and they began to hit it off at that level when Kevin was still a teenager. And Gino has followed his career playing in the NBA very closely, and they've remained close friends. And now that they're peers, they are very tight, unlike Auriemma and Jim Calhoun, who were polar opposites in personalities. They very rarely spoke to each other.
After halftime, the women's championship game was not close, and that marked the 9th championship for UConn, their 5th undefeated season. As far as the state of women's basketball is concerned, is there such a thing as one team being too good?
Before I got involved in this very interesting gig, I spent years covering the NHL, and I spent 10 years covering the New York Giants and the NFL, and I've been immersed for a long time in the male-dominated world, and my friends often ask me, how do you deal with covering women's basketball? I always tell them the same thing. This guy, this little Italian immigrant, Gino Auriemma, is to college sports what Walter Camp was to football, what John Wooden was to men's basketball. And he is to women's basketball what Lombardi was to the NFL. He's a seminal figure who has changed the sport in every single way, both in terms of how little girls that want to play it look at it, how television covers it. Maybe in 25 years when I'm old and jowled and sitting in a chair, ESPN will come into my living room and I'll feel like David McCullough talking about John Adams. I'm looking forward to that day, you know?
Paul, Kevin Ollie is only in his second year in charge of the men's team at UConn, but he's suddenly the hot young head coach. Has he got the players to continue the success that he enjoyed this season?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, look at their roster. I know they lose Napier, but I think that he's got it all pointed up. And I think you look at what he's done and how the team and the players seem to rally around him. If he stays at UConn, the sky's the limit. The only question is whether at some point he does find the NBA to be an appealing position, maybe to test himself and to move forward, you know, in his career. That's the only question I have.
You know, Paul, you're mentioning that, and it is interesting because two of his biggest supporters during his career in the NBA were LeBron James and Kevin Durant. He was on their teams when they broke into the leagues, and they love him. They're going to advocate for him maybe soon to be an NBA coach because of the respect they have. I think Connecticut's biggest challenge, as Paul alluded to, is not going to be trying to repeat as a national champion. It's going to be figuring out how to keep him on campus.
UConn won both national titles back in 2004. They've done it again this year. Is there another program that could possibly aspire to that achievement at this point?
You know, there are certain basketball programs, obviously. You look at a Kentucky, Michigan State in the same class. There are a few schools out west that have that kind of ability to put forth a contender every year. I think I'd have to rely on John's expertise on the women's side, but certainly UConn stands heads and shoulders above the rest, but there may be two or three who could join that class.
Well, up until this year, there were only three other instances in the history of NCAA Division I basketball where one school battled for championships in the same season. It was 1999. Duke had their men and women in the title game. Of course, the UConn teams that won the dual championships in 2004, and last year, ironically enough, in 2013, when the Louisville men won their national championship, the Louisville women played Connecticut for the championship of the NCAAs, and then again this year, obviously the fourth time. If there's going to be a program that has a chance of doing it again, only because 50% of it's already taken care of with the women, it would be UConn.
John Altavilla covers the UConn women's team for the Hartford Courant. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
And Paul Meyerberg is a writer for USA Today. Paul, thank you for joining me.
It was a pleasure. Talk to you soon.
On Friday in Philadelphia, Boston College junior Johnny Gaudreau was announced as the winner of the 2014 Hobey Baker Award. 100 years ago, before there was Babe Ruth, before there was Joe Louis, and way before there was Michael Jordan, the preeminent American athlete was a hockey player who hailed from Bala Cynwyd, Pennsylvania. His name was Hobart Amory Hare, a.k.a. Hobie Baker. WHYY's John Weber reports on the award for the nation's top college hockey player and the man for whom it was named.
Hobie Baker was the son of wealthy upholsterer Alfred Thornton Baker and Mary Augusta Pemberton, a Philadelphia socialite. His parents divorced when he was 11, and Hobie and his brother Thornton were shipped off to St. Paul's, a residential high school in Concord, New Hampshire. Paul Alley wrote and directed Golden, the Hobie Baker story. He says it was there that Baker discovered he was a natural athlete.
There wasn't any sport that he got near that he wasn't able to master. And instead of the guys being jealous of him, this kid was so gentle of spirit and so natural at what he did that they just admired him.
It was at St. Paul's where Baker learned to play hockey, and it's said that he would skate in the dark of night on the frozen ponds of New Hampshire to perfect his skating and stick handling skills. He made the varsity team in his sophomore year. Upon graduation, Baker headed to Princeton University, where he starred in hockey and football. Again, Paul Alley.
When he showed up and got hold of a football and just ran up and down that field, people were astonished, and with hockey. They started to call him the Blonde Adonis, and Princeton was glad to have him.
Baker tallied 180 points on the gridiron, a Princeton record that stood for half a century. He's believed to have scored 120 goals in hockey for Old Nassau. But it wasn't just his athletic prowess he was known for. Langhorne, Pennsylvania resident Adam Woden, managing editor of collegehockeynews.com, says Hobey Baker was both the ultimate gentleman and sportsman.
He was considered not just the greatest athlete of his generation, along with Jim Thorpe, but also one of the greatest gentlemen. I mean, he took one penalty in his career. That's the legendary story. All the research you do suggests that that is indeed true, not just something that was apocryphal.
After graduation from Princeton, Baker worked for a time on Wall Street. But according to the official Hobey Baker website, he was bored by corporate America. So when World War I broke out, he had a calling.
He then went into the military. Once the United States entered World War I, he was part of the U.S. Army Air Corps and flew in several missions over France and was credited with 3 enemy kills during the course of his career.
That's Wally Shaver. He's the legendary radio voice of the University of Minnesota Golden Gophers hockey team, as well as being the publicity director for the Hobey Baker Foundation and Award.
Unfortunately, Hobey Baker died. He had his return papers in his pocket, but took a repaired aircraft up for one last flight. It went about a quarter mile down the runway, got airborne, and crash-landed, and Hobey Baker passed away in the ambulance on the way to the hospital.
When news of his death reached the States, a national day of mourning was declared. In 1923, a hockey arena was built in his name at Princeton. Even though he's the only athlete to have been inducted into the Hockey and College Football Halls of Fame, Baker had faded out of the national consciousness. Then in 1981, a group of enthusiasts headed up by Chuck Bard at the Decathlon Club in Bloomington, Minnesota, established the Hobey Baker Award. Paul Lally hopes that more people will come to know about the gentleman sportsman from Bala Cynwyd, Pennsylvania.
Hobey was the greatest player who ever put on a pair of skates.
This year's ceremony took place at the Kimmel Center, less than 5 miles away from Baker's final resting place in West Laurel Hill Cemetery. For Only a Game, I'm John Weber.
Ahead on Only a Game, the Phoenix Mercury's Brittany Griner on her seasons at Baylor University and her current life in the pros. But first, after a very strong start to their season and talk of championship contention, the Indiana Pacers have recently been losing twice for every win. This is not a good time for that because the NBA regular season ends on Wednesday. Joining me now to explore the rapidly decelerating Pacers is Bob Kravitz of the Indianapolis Star. Bob, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
As you mentioned in your column of April 9th, the Pacers have said all year that being the Eastern Conference's number one seed is their number one priority, and now head coach Frank Vogel is saying, that goal is simply to play well. Why the sudden shift?
Well, because they've been awful. A lot of guys are struggling. Their star player, Paul George, has not been very good the last 30 games. A lot of guys are in shooting slumps. Right now, the priority, by Frank Vogel's estimation, is, look, if we get number one, great. If we get number two, that's fine, too, as long as we're rested and playing well going into the playoffs. But it's desperate times, desperate measures around here in Indianapolis.
Normally, resting players toward the end of the season might make perfect sense, but the Pacers have a young roster. Are they really tired?
That's what they say. I think that's a default explanation from a bunch of guys who really don't have any answers. That's something of a cop-out. I'm getting fatigued just listening to them talk about fatigue, and I think there are issues that are much greater than that. I just don't think they handled stardom particularly well, especially Paul George.
In February, the Pacers traded forward Danny Granger to Philadelphia for guard Evan Turner and forward Lavoie Allen. Before the trade, the Pacers were 41-13. They've played 500 basketball since then. Is that trade the reason for the Pacers' poor play?
I don't think that it is. First of all, they struggled the 2 weeks before the Danny Granger trade. Certainly, Granger was a veteran. It did change the chemistry of the locker room a little bit, and Evan Turner has struggled. But if that's what sends you reeling, then you've got bigger problems than you're willing to acknowledge.
The defending champion Miami Heat haven't exactly been world beaters this season.
No.
Despite the Pacers' recent slide, shouldn't this still be seen as a golden opportunity for Indiana?
Well, absolutely. But if you look at it objectively, the way the league lines up right now, the number two seed is probably the easier way to get to the Eastern Conference Finals than the number one seed. But I don't think they're tanking in an effort to get the number two. It just kind of looks that way.
There's a memorable scene in the movie It's a Wonderful Life in which the very rich old man Potter offers the not-so-rich George Bailey a job with a handsome salary. Bailey turns it down, and Potter asks him if he's afraid of success. Are the Pacers the George Bailey of the NBA?
They might be. I don't know that they're afraid of success so much as they were ill-equipped to handle success. You know, all of a sudden they're doing Gatorade ads and GQ cover shoots, and they're the toast of the NBA, and I think it's a cop-out. Look at the Oklahoma City Thunder. They're no younger than the Pacers, and they've been able to maintain even when they've been the toast of the NBA.
I want to end this conversation on an up note, if we can, Bob. Indiana has clinched a playoff spot and still has a chance to earn the best record in the Eastern Conference. Maybe all these alarm bells are going off too early.
It's possible, but this has been going on for 38 to 40 games. I don't know how they're going to just sort of flip the switch and suddenly start playing well in the playoffs, but I've been wrong before, but not often.
Bob Kravitz is a columnist for the Indianapolis Star. Bob, thank you very much for joining me.
Okay, thank you very much.
If you like men's and women's basketball, college and pro, but can't decide which you like better, there's a new league that might be for you. The Mixed Gender Basketball Association is gearing up for its inaugural season and will pit teams comprised of male and female players against each other. WNYC's Jim O'Grady went to a recent tryout in East Harlem to watch the sexes mixing on the hardwood.
Dr. John Howard Jr., a star forward at Cincinnati in the late 60s, says the idea began to germinate in 1986 when he was principal at Buena Vista High School. The Saginaw, Michigan school had a girl who was so good at basketball that Howard believed the only way to fulfill her talent was to have her play varsity on the boys' team.
She was not given an opportunity because the Michigan High School Athletic Association would not accept the opportunity for me to allow her to play.
Howard says it killed him to watch the boys go on to win the state championship while the best player in the school, who happened to be a girl, watched from the sideline. Howard is now working full-time to put together an 8-10 team mixed-gender basketball league, 12 players to a team, all paid equally. The first teams will be based in the Northeast, Philadelphia, Delaware, New York, New Jersey. He says the season will tip off in July. But with the WNBA and other leagues, there's no shortage of ways to see women play pro ball. Why does Howard think fans will pay to see his games?
More excitement, drama, suspense, and guess what? The unknown. People are going to pay for the unknown. People want to see how men play against women and how the women play against men. It's that unknown factor.
Howard's a salesman who takes every chance to push the novelty of his concept. That includes the team's logo, which depicts a woman scoring over a man. And that raises another issue.
One of the big questions in the room is, how do you manage the male ego when it comes to this?
The women do that.
How do they do that?
They do it by shooting a four-point shot.
That's right. If a woman hits a shot from beyond the professional three-point arc, it counts as 4 points.
It doesn't water down the game. It just gives the woman equity in the game.
In the first quarter, teams will have 3 men and 2 women, a ratio that flips with each quarter. If a team is behind late in the game, it can play up to 5 women to improve their chances of hitting 4-point shots. 23-year-old Talia Boye has a pretty good outside shot, which she honed playing guard and forward in a pro league in Switzerland. She was at the Harlem tryout in late March.
I think it's very interesting, girls and guys playing together, and just to be able to play professional ball here at home is basically a huge privilege.
What's interesting about girls and guys together?
It's just better to play, I guess, with guys because they're quicker, and you get more competition out of the guys than you do with girls because girls don't like to get in the gym always.
A few women, like Basketball Hall of Famers Ann Myers and Nancy Lieberman, have competed with men at the pro level. But those were exceptions. In this league, mixed-gender squads are the rule. That's why Martin Dunkley, who will be coaching a team based in upstate New York, was evaluating the men for their ability to blend with the women.
What does that mean? That a guy is not too macho to pass to a woman?
Absolutely. Well, hey, listen, they're not going to be in the league if that's the case, right? So.
Really? And they know that?
Oh, yeah, they know that.
Set a pick! Set a pick!
Conversely, Howard made a point of telling the women at the tryout not to expect special treatment. He said if they set a pick on a guy, they should expect him to use his strength to fight through it. What does Talia Boye think about that? Well, she's strong, but a lot of the guys she's up against are stronger.
That's fine with me. I think when it comes to basketball, if you love the game of basketball, it's just about basketball. So it's not really about gender, race, anything. It's just about winning the game, doing what you got to do to score points, play D, get stops, win.
Romeo Bartley, a 27-year-old shooting guard who's played as a pro in the ABA, takes the same pragmatic approach. He's here to win, make a bit of a living, and maybe move on to something better.
It's just a perfect opportunity for everyone to showcase their talent. Some people didn't play for college, such as myself, that's actually extremely good and is trying to make it to the next level.
And do you worry that there's any sort of like stigma or people look down on a league where guys play with women?
Everybody's equal. It really doesn't matter who we play with or who we play against.
The league held an exhibition game in February between two of its teams, the South Jersey Jammers and the North Jersey Ballers. It sounded like any tight basketball game. The Ballers were down 2 points with possession and 5 seconds left.
In the corner, that's a three-pointer. Oh, no good.
Two of the league's July games will be played about a half mile from the tryouts at Harlem's legendary Rucker Park. If Dr. Howard can put a quality product on those courts in front of those fans who are used to seeing NBA players show up for games, he'll have taken a big step forward toward making his league legit. For Only a Game, I'm Jim O'Grady in New York.
Which sports do you think work best in a mixed-gender format? Tell us about them by using our new Facebook handle, facebook.com/onlyagamenpr. While you're there, you can also view mixed-gender basketball photos. For those who prefer the Twitterverse, our new Twitter handle is twitter.com/onlyagamenpr. On Wednesday, University of Massachusetts guard Derek Gordon became the first openly gay Division I men's basketball player. Almost exactly a year prior to that, Brittany Griner, then the standout center for Baylor University, also came out. Griner tells the story in her recently released autobiography, In My Skin, and relates how she spent a considerable portion of her childhood wishing away her size, strength, and tenacity. Numbers of basketball players overwhelmed by the 6-foot-8-inch Griner when she was playing for Baylor no doubt wish those wishes had come true. Brittany Griner now plays for the WNBA's Phoenix Mercury. She joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. Brittany, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
That 2012 Baylor team, which you led, went undefeated and won the NCAA championship. Obviously, you were in the national spotlight throughout that year. Did you enjoy the attention?
Definitely. I learned to enjoy the attention over time, but it was a great season. It was a great time just to, you know, have with my teammates and my coach.
During that championship season with Baylor, you and your teammates experienced perfection, at least in terms of what you accomplished on the court. Is there any way to strive for that same sort of satisfaction now in the pros?
Definitely. Especially this year, I want to strive for the same perfection that we got at Baylor. I remember, you know, everything that it took going in every day, before practice, after practice, long hours in the gym, and just working together as a team and a unit to, you know, go in every game and fight to get that win. I definitely am striving to get that same perfection as I did my junior year at Baylor.
As you point out in My Skin, Baylor is and was institutionally opposed to gays and lesbians. The school has a published policy to that effect. You told Coach Mulkey even before you started school at Baylor that you were gay, though you say in the book that you had no knowledge of Baylor's anti-gay stance at that time. What led you to offer that information to the coach, and how did she respond?
I just wanted to let her know, you know, who I was. And, you know, I was going through things, you know, just coming out and at home. And she came back and told me that, you know, it wasn't a big deal. As long as I came and did what I needed to do, everything would be good.
Of your relationship with Kim Mulkey, you say there was always a bit of a disconnect. This is in part because you never knew if she accepted you for who you are. In retrospect, do you ever wish you'd played your college basketball somewhere else where that disconnect wouldn't have been an issue?
Never, never. I enjoyed all my years at Baylor. Coach Mulkey taught me lessons on and off the court. I met tremendous people that I love and still, you know, connect with now to this day.
Obviously, Kim Mulkey was elated when you chose Baylor. As you report, she shouted, "Big girl is coming to Baylor." But once the initial excitement wore off, she was less than delighted with your tattoos, which she made you cover up by wearing a T-shirt under your jersey. Would she have imposed that restriction on any other player?
Other teammates of mine had tattoos that they didn't have to cover, but I had to cover up my stars that I got on my shoulders.
Why just you?
You know, Coach, she didn't want anybody to think, you know, anything of me by having the tattoos. And, you know, she was always looking out for me. And I really, truly believe she was looking out for me. But I wanted to show my ink.
And you got to once you got to the WNBA.
Oh, definitely. I show all my ink off now.
You describe the process of recruiting athletes as, and again, I'm quoting here, one big song and dance with everybody playing a role. How would you change that process if you could do so?
I think when different schools will stop looking at a player's, you know, orientation and just focus strictly on, you know, just the player's performance, I think it'll be better. I don't think anybody would want to go to a school and then have to change who they are.
Would there be a way of maybe diminishing the pressure on 17, 18-year-olds trying to decide which coach they should believe?
Honestly, with more athletes coming out and you know, telling their story and it becoming less of a big deal, then honestly, we won't have to think about it at all in recruiting. We'll just, you know, pick a school and go wherever, you know, we choose to go.
You characterize becoming a professional player as a liberating experience in the book. Tell us a little bit more about the liberation.
You can be your own self. You don't have to hide. You don't have to worry about anything, honestly, you know, becoming a professional athlete. I felt so free and able to really become who I am and, you know, tell my story. And that was one of the biggest things for me, just being able to be true to myself.
Then, of course, the Mercury began your rookie season by losing more games in 2 weeks than Baylor had lost in the previous 2 years, so that adjustment must have been a bit of a challenge.
It was an adjustment. I just had to learn how to be a better player. I had to learn how, you know, it's not going to come easy. I kind of took for granted winning at Baylor. Like, I would go into a game kind of like, okay, we're going to get this. I had to learn to get that fight back, honestly.
You have also had the opportunity to play pro basketball in China, which must have required all sorts of even more dramatic adjustments on and off the court. Is that something you're going to do again?
I will definitely do that again. Playing overseas just helps out your game so much. Different coaching, different style of play. You know, it's just it's a little bit different over there, on and off the court. Eating was my biggest thing. I had to find somewhere to eat and get food.
The easily available fare was not agreeable?
Not really. I went. Fast food was my best friend overseas, honestly. I lived off of it.
Toward the end of In My Skin, there's a passage which I found exceptional for its candor. You say, "Technically, I'm an adult, but I'm still learning what that means exactly." How's that process going these days?
It's going good. I actually learned a lot overseas about myself. I always depend, you know, on somebody to be there for me and with me and, you know, help me out. And when I was overseas, you know, you're by yourself. You really kind of learn to find yourself and how to be alone and deal with things on your own. So overseas definitely helped me grow as a person.
With Sue Hovey, Brittany Griner of the WNBA's Phoenix Mercury wrote, "In My Skin, My Life on and Off the Basketball Court." Brittany, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a great time.
To read my review of Brittany Griner's book, In My Skin, please go to onlyagame.org. And note, please, that we've got a new Facebook address, facebook.com/onlyagamenpr. If you already like us on Facebook, you'll still get our post. But if you haven't yet, check out facebook.com/onlyagamenpr, which is also our new Twitter handle.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Eton, offering the American Red Cross radio line, a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel, now at Radio Shack. And the Music Emporium, for 45 years, offering collectible boutique and vintage acoustic guitars, themusicemporium.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Changes at Augusta. Wait, is that a misprint? No, it really says Changes at Augusta. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Once every century and a half, whether they need them or not.
Exactly. On Monday, the University of Connecticut men's basketball team won the national championship. And on Tuesday, the UConn women's basketball team won the national championship. Any idea how the school's baseball and softball teams are looking?
I don't know, but it was a great parlay if you were a Connecticut basketball fan, because the first night you were the underdog and the second night you were the ridiculous overdog.
Following that Monday night win, fans back in Storrs, Connecticut rioted, and following Tuesday night's win, they didn't. Do you suppose they were just too tired to riot on two consecutive nights?
I just hope there isn't some sort of Title IX violation here. I mean, women deserve to have their victory celebrated with rioting and car flipping and academic building window smashing with light poles.
To be completely straightforward about this, there was considerable celebration. Gamble Pavilion at Storrs was full of people watching this game on the big screens both nights.
Right.
So they had a fine time. After UConn guard Shabazz Napier told the world that he sometimes goes hungry at night because he doesn't have enough money to buy food, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver responded by saying the NBA might be willing to pitch in to help pay for basketball players' basic needs while they were still in college. Would that solve everything?
It wouldn't solve everything. It would solve the occasional some things. The business model for collegiate sports is collapsing at all points of the compass. Apparently, the NBA, which still wants to keep college students in college for at least 2 years, is apparently now willing to sort of bribe them to stay there.
I could just see this. You know, you're in your dorm room and knock, knock. Hi, here's your pepperoni pizza, courtesy of the NBA.
Well, no, I want to know if the league pays, you know, gives you your spending money for 2 years or whatever. Do you have to pay them back when you sign?
Seeing as it would be peanuts, that wouldn't be too much of a stretch, I would think. Unwilling to wait around and see if change is coming, Kansas freshman Joel Embiid has declared for the NBA draft, Charlie. He was predicted to go first in the draft until a back injury forced him out of the Big 12 and NCAA tournaments. Will somebody take a gamble on this seven-footer with a gimpy back?
This is no gamble. This was, at least by my lights, the most interesting and probably most talented player in the country before he got hurt. This is a legitimate center who blocks shots, who runs the floor. He will not go lower than five.
Derek Gordon, a sophomore who plays basketball for the University of Massachusetts, announced this week that he is gay, thereby becoming the first Division I men's basketball player to do so. Are we close at all to reaching the time when announcements like this will no longer be news?
We're closer than we were, and I think this and this is directly attributed by Derek Gordon to Jason Collins' decision to come out.
Mm-hmm. As the NBA teams roar, stumble, or tank their way through the last week of the season, MVP talk is heating up. LeBron James has said that Kevin Durant would be a fine choice for that honor. So is that a statement of the obvious or a gracious concession from the fellow who often looks like he could win the MVP anytime he wanted to?
I think it's both, and I think it's dead accurate. I think LeBron James will be handing the trophy over to Kevin Durant this year.
Moving on to the National Hockey League, the Washington Capitals are sitting out the postseason for the first time since 2007. I know you are not prone to criticism of Capitals captain Alex Ovechkin, so it must be somebody else's fault.
No, I'll tell you, he's going to really take the heat for this one because there's no way the Capitals should be out of the playoffs, and he's the biggest and most obvious target.
Nine former players sued the NHL over concussions this week. Two of the plaintiffs are all-star defenseman Brad Maxwell and Jack Carlson, best known as one of the Hanson brothers from Only a Game's favorite comedy about the sports slapshot. But this suit is no laughing matter.
No, there's also another one filed in Washington by 10 former NHL players. This is, once again, this is the beginning of the deluge.
The Carolina Panthers have renamed what used to be called the 400 level in their arena. It's now the 300 level. Is the arena sinking?
No, they covered up the seats they can't sell with a curtain. I guess they'll find something stylish to do with it, but they don't draw, so it looks really bad on TV.
I know they do this for soccer games played in football stadiums sometime. It must be a bad sign when a hockey team does it.
Oh, it's not good at all.
It's early in the Major League Baseball season, of course, but the Kansas City Royals have done something no other team has done since 1990. What was that?
They went seven games without hitting a home run. The last team to do it, oddly enough, was the Yankees. The last team to go without a home run through the first eight games, Alex Gordon managed to stave off this, was the 85 Astros. That was 29 years ago.
Boston Red Sox slugger David Ortiz also found himself in the record books this week. What was Big Poppy's latest feat?
He hit a home run, and it took him almost 33 seconds to go around the base paths.
Well, the first 18 was spent watching.
You could blindfold somebody, and they could go around faster than that.
Harvard Business School has announced an addition to their faculty, Charlie, former Manchester United manager Sir Alex Ferguson. Do you suppose he'll teach a course on how to leave a successful business just as it's beginning to crumble into dust?
Well, then they're standing in seventh in the Premier League right now. He's apparently going to teach, and he should become a regular contributor, I think, to Only a Game, the business of entertainment, media, and sports, which is apparently there was a professor at Harvard who developed a case study involving Ferguson, and apparently he's been over and sat in on some of the classes and likes it, so now we're going to have Professor Sir Alex Ferguson.
The Los Angeles Dodgers don't have a new mascot. They have a new, quote, unique performance character. Are we supposed to call him that because it's Los Angeles or because this hideous creature is too scary looking to be called a mascot?
It's a guy with a big head. If you have a big head, you're a mascot.
Yeah, but look at his smile. He looks like he stepped right off the set of a horror movie.
Well, he's sort of got a cowlick thing going in front. I don't know what that's all about. But the little kid who's in front of him in the picture looks okay, but the father looks very nervous.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, among other places. Charlie, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bill.
Historically, change has not been welcome at Augusta National Golf Club, site of the Masters, which began on Thursday. The club, which was established in 1933, admitted women for the first time just 2 years ago. But this week, USA Today columnist Christine Brennan found intimations of, dare we call it, progress? Christine, welcome back to Only a Game.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
Of the activity you witnessed last Sunday at Augusta, you wrote, female golfers had taken over the place. Explain, please.
Yes, Augusta, in conjunction with the USGA and the PGA of America, came up with a competition called Drive, Chip, and Putt. And they came up with champions, and then they brought 44 girls and 44 boys to Augusta National to compete on the grounds, the hallowed grounds of Augusta, including putting from the spot where Adam Scott sank a big putt in his journey to victory last year. Mm-hmm. It was equal in all ways. I mean, for the first time ever, girls had equal billing on the course with boys, something that would have been unthinkable even 2 years ago. So it's an effort not just to show that Augusta has entered the 20th century before too much more of the 21st went by, but also I think it's this effort to grow the game because, frankly, golf is hemorrhaging participants, and of course, inviting girls and women to play at the venerable Augusta National is certainly one way to show that the sport is welcoming to 51% of the population.
As I mentioned, the club admitted women for the first time just 2 years ago. Has that changed everything for anybody but Condoleezza Rice?
It's changed because there are now women, you know, and that's the good news, right? Now, 2 out of 300 plus or whatever it is, we don't know the exact numbers. You know, that's not exactly a great percentage, but it's a start. You know, Condi Rice is having the time of her life here. She, of course, is an avid golfer. She shows up everywhere, avid sports fan. You know, she's at the Women's Final Four. She's on the committee to pick the college football playoff teams starting this coming season. So she's everywhere and really has become, Bill, the face of the course. Last year, she was this force. Everywhere you went, she was there greeting fans, greeting other members. Very visible, very smart move, by the way, on the part of Billy Payne, who's the chairman of Augusta National. You know, okay, now you've got women, and you've got this very famous woman, former Secretary of State. Let's let the world see that we have her. And I think that's why there is progress, because they do understand that they were far behind the times.
In a recent USA Today story, you speculated as follows, as Augusta goes, so goes the golf industry. Why is that?
Well, because it's the high time that these guys, and mostly it is men, decided that capitalism could trump sexism. But over the years, it was amazing to me to watch this. And as you may know, in 1999, my first trip down here as a columnist for USA Today, I asked a question, just, do you have any women members? And this sent shockwaves, apparently. And all I did was Journalism 101. I asked a simple question. And we were off on the Hootie Johnson-Martha Burke thing, and, you know, on and on it went. Now that Augusta has realized, boy, we need to have some women members, I would love to say it's altruism, but I do think it's a cry for help from the golf industry. all the club makers, all the apparel makers, all the people who are building golf courses that have been plowed under because of the economy. Golf is not a sport on the rise. It is a sport on the decline. So Augusta needs to show people, hey, women are welcome, because that is the demographic. That's the growth industry. Women and girls are the untapped market.
U.S. Golf Association President Thomas J. O'Toole acknowledged this week that his game, quote, has a significant legacy of exclusion and elitism, and that golf has not been welcoming. How else will Mr. O'Toole and others address this legacy beyond staging contests for children at Augusta?
It's a fascinating question, and I'm not so sure that it's going to work, and I tend to be a very optimistic person, and I wish them well. But I don't know. For example, experts have talked about things like daycare, so that young moms can take their kids and put them in daycare and go play a few holes. How about a round of golf that is three holes, or a round of golf that is six holes? And you're laughing, right? And I'm smiling too. But very few people, especially young people, especially young women, have time to go play 18 holes of golf. Frankly, it's hard to find time to play nine holes of golf. I played golf. My dad made sure that his daughters as well as his son would be adept at playing golf and feel welcome on a golf course. And I haven't hit a golf ball except on a driving range with my niece and nephew in 2 or 3 years. I can't make the time to play golf. That's fine. I'm not missing it, and it's not missing me. But but the reality is golf is going to have to change in fundamental ways, Bill, and it's a fascinating conversation. Because, again, the options that are there, especially because of Title IX for girls and women, are you kidding me? Okay, that sport is slow, takes too long, old, it's my grandfather's sport, it's too lily white, it's too male dominant. Whatever the argument would be about golf, I'm going to go find, you know, 15 other sports to play. That's why they have to think outside the box. But they've been so loath to do that as an industry, and the country club set especially. I just don't know how it happens.
Christine Brennan writes about golf, among other things, for USA Today. Christine, thank you very much.
Bill, my pleasure. Thanks again.
No detail is too small for the folks who prepare Augusta National Golf Club for the Masters Tournament every year. Trees, flowers, and greens have been hand-watered. Fairways have been cut morning and night. And during this week's event, patrons were handed green drink napkins that perfectly matched the grass, just in case some slob has the poor taste to drop one. What does it take to make a product deemed worthy of the attention of the gentlemen and two ladies in green jackets? For more on that, we go to Only a Game's Karen Given.
The sewing room at New England Flag and Banner is humming with activity. It's been that way for a while now. The company's been around since 1892. The current owner, Ned Flynn, has only been in charge since 2006. But not surprisingly, he starts our conversation with a look at the past.
This is the oldest picture that I've seen that we have. It came out of the archives. It's from
Among the photos on Flynn's wall is one of Fenway Park, adorned with red, white, and blue bunting to celebrate the return of baseball after World War II. More recently, the company has made the championship banners, which covered the entire green monster for opening day. In fact, they made the championship banners that permanently hang in the rafters of many pro sports venues. The LA Kings loved theirs so much, they made a short documentary about it. Those huge Velcro banners high school football teams break through before home games, many of those were made here, as are the ones passed around in the stands at universities such as Notre Dame and Kansas. Listing all the schools New England Flag and Banner works with could take all day.
You know, you start at the West Coast in the upper left-hand side, and you've got Washington, Washington State, Gonzaga, Stanford.
Flynn walks me through the geography of the entire United States by listing the colleges his company has made flags and banners for. He estimates he has about a 90% market share, and I'll admit, I can't think of anyone he hasn't mentioned.
University of Florida, Florida State, the entire SEC region, all the way up to University of Maine. It's pretty cool. So almost all the games I watch now, I'm thinking to myself, if not saying out loud, how's that flag look? It's true.
A lot goes into a good-looking, hand-sewn applique flag or championship banner. After the design is finished, it's sent to computerized plotters, which poke holes in large pieces of paper. Staples temporarily hold together full sheets of brightly colored fabric, usually nylon. The paper is used as a stencil to mark the pattern, but the design isn't cut out, at least not yet. Skilled sewers, some of whom have been working here for 30 years, deftly zigzag around the stenciled marks. And finally, the extra fabric is cut off by hand, layer by layer, revealing the design.
It's counterintuitive. People think that we sew letters on and sew logos on. It's actually the opposite. What we do is we sew the image on, and then we cut everything around it off.
When the sewing room makes a particularly cool banner, say one with the Olympic rings on it, they sometimes hang an extra on their wall. And I promised you a master's story, so I guess I need to point out that one of those banners is very, very green.
There is a very green banner on the wall from a somewhat famous golf tournament that takes place in April every year. We've been lucky enough to be making their flags for the clubhouse and their driving range. Every year we sign a new non-disclosure agreement with them, so we won't mention who it is, but it certainly is green.
He's not at liberty to say more, but it's clear Ned Flynn is proud of his 122-year-old company's association with all of the storied institutions whose logos grace his factory wall.
Anytime you do a Stanley Cup championship or a world championship or whatever, it's all great, but there are some that kind of transcend the rest, and I think the one from Georgia kind of transcends the rest. Is that opaque enough?
It's opaque enough for me. I just hope the folks down in Georgia agree. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is James Trout. We had help this week from Martin Kessler and Eddie Mazulis. Our intern is Zoe Sobel, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week is from New England Flag and Banner President Ned Flynn, who describes one of his shop's morning routines.
Everybody on the tables in the layout gets up and they play badminton. And they are not good, they're great.
If that charming routine ever develops into a league, they'll be all set because, hey, free banners and flags. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. The Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.